Welcome to Bigfoot Notes from the Field. I'm your host, William Jevney.
We're speaking today with, now Don, how do you pronounce, is it Gummo?
Gummo,
how do you pronounce your last name? Gummo. Don Gummo. Yeah. Now, I guess I should have asked you first if it was okay to use your name or not.
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay. Let me get back here. I'm looking for, and Jeremiah Fountain, who is our regional director for the northeastern part of the United States and Canada for the Jevney Research Group. Fellas, how are you doing today?
Good, and good. Wanted to mention, Don is our team leader in Maine.
Actually. Awesome, awesome.
So he's one of our own on this, on these hours, you know.
And that's something that I do want to talk about is having, you know, since our own people with the Jevning Research Group are in the field around the country, periodically we will have updates, you know, with this show so that you, the listener, can hear what's going on with our organization besides just witnesses that we come across when we're out and about. So, Don, let's go ahead, and what we'll talk about, I guess, is we'll start with the beginning with you. The first time, let me back up a little bit. Let's ask a little bit about you yourself. What would you like to tell us about yourself?
Well, let's see, 51 years old. My field was mostly electronics. I got my degree in electronics, and that's pretty much what I've worked. And then ever since I've been disabled, I was hit by a car. I got into foraging and got back into this subject, which I got into at about 13 years old, living down near the Hockomock Swamp down in eastern Mass. I've heard of many encounters in that area. I myself had never seen anything down there. I don't know, probably 50 excursions out into that swamp and had never seen any kind of creature. We did pull a wolf out of the water one day. Well, we swear it was a wolf, but...
Oh, wow.
That's a crazy story in itself.
It was huge.
That's pretty interesting, huh? I mean...
Yeah. It was... We were probably about 17, 18 at the time, and we knew it was... We thought it was a baby cow or a small cow or something at first. It was all bloated. One side was all skin. And then when we flipped it up, when we got it on the shore, it was all gray fur, smoke gray fur on the other side. And it was had a dog head, more like a wolf head. But all I could do was measure the front leg at the time. And I remember using my oar and then measuring the front leg and holding it to my leg. And it came right to my belt line, right to my hip bone. And my German Shepherd comes to my knee, you know, just above my knee. So we knew this thing was huge. And... after the canoe trip, we called Fish and Game and told them about it, and they said they would check it out. And first thing in the morning, we went back out there with the canoe to wait for them, and it was gone when we got there. Now, a snapping turtle may have dragged it back into the water.
Yeah.
Not sure what happened to it, but when I called Fish and Game back, they said that they had never gone down there, and they had never intended to go down there either.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, they were all interested. Well, first, but okay.
Yeah. Now, what got your interest in this subject? Were there a lot of stories circulating in that area when you were a young person, or?
Yes, a lot of my friends. I lived right next to West Meadows, which is part of the Hockomock Swamp, and all in this area, I had heard my first encounter. I was in seventh grade, and a friend of mine's brother, who was in eighth grade, had gone out there and saw a gray one run from them. And about a year later, I had a friend of mine out in the Hockomock who was hunting out there, and they had one walk into their campsite in the middle of the night, and he also described it as gray.
And probably the same individual then.
Well, I was wondering that because there was another report in three or four towns away of another gray one just recently. All the reports in this area always seem to be gray for some reason. I know Jeremy had mentioned it might be a trait. That they have, but
it's possible, yeah.
A genetic thing, possibly. Will you think within within that family group,
it is a possibility. Or I guess you'd have to look at the time frames from one sighting to the next.
Sure,
right.
And if you had particulars with footprints and things like that, you might be able to determine if it was multiple individuals.
Absolutely.
In the same one.
Yeah, I wish I knew now. What I know then, what I know now, because we never looked for footprints. We never did any of that. We were just, as kids, we were just looking for the creature out there.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, but so, that's what got me into stories. It, because everybody said it was gray, and that seemed odd to me, because at that time, it was about 1977, in that time range, I had never heard of a gray Sasquatch.
Everybody was reporting them brown or black, I think, at the time, or actually cinnamon.
Cinnamon.
The cinnamon brown color was the predominant one at that time.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and that's what just caught my eye, that everyone was seeing something gray. So,
what did you mention?
I knew they were seeing something, you know.
You remember how you were, I think Will might find this interesting. I know, you know, they mentioned in a couple of these gray individuals that the face was more old mannish looking on some of them than others.
Yeah.
Now, remember how you were telling me you were canoeing with a buddy down through the swamp, and there was a face peeking out at you. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, when I first started to go out into the swamp, my father grew up in that area and always told us to look out for the hermits that lived out there. And there actually were people that did live out there, and I know they had caught a few of them and taken a few in, the police had. But we were always on the lookout, and we were deep in the swamp one day, and we heard something, and I remember canoeing, looking to the side, and seeing a face in the bushes. And back then, I remember saying, oh, it's got to be one of those hermits. And we just kept going and never looked twice at it. But when I go back to look at that area, I know the area inside the swamp a little bit better now. You can't get to that area by walking. It's either a boat, or you have to trudge through the swamp to get to that spot. It just wasn't a spot that a hermit would live or anybody else would live, you know?
Sure.
And my father grew up in that town, West Bridgewater, and he said ever since he was a kid, he has heard stories of the creatures out there, you know? And so
it's got a pretty good history of the area.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it definitely does. There's burial mounds out there. And there's a lot of, I mean, Hockomock means the place where the spirits dwell. That was the Indian name for it. Mm-hmm. So there's a few grave spots out there, a few mounds. Unfortunately, I went out there recently, and I can see that people are digging these mounds up.
Oh.
So, yeah, I did kind of report it, but I haven't been in that area in so many years, and it was always pretty quiet out there and pretty desolate, but now it's full of four-wheeler trails. They let everybody out there now.
Oh, yes, so they'll be tearing it up.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, now with all that information going on, that's what interested you as a young person to go out there and look around, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So, and that was the time you had your first encounter?
No, actually, my first encounter was about 1999 or 2000.
Okay.
Yep.
So what were you doing that day, you know, prior to the encounter?
We were... me and a buddy of mine brought our metal detectors up to Vermont. He grew up at the top of Vermont in Montgomery Center. So he knew that area well, and we were just bringing our metal detectors to old homesteads up in that area, and we were going to go on a walk on the long trail up there. And there's a place, Hazen's Notch is where we started. We were right on Hazen's Notch Road, and the long trail crosses it. We parked the car, and we started walking, and I don't think we walked more than 75 feet. And I know I bent down to either tie my shoe or to pick up a rock or something. But when I bent down, that's when the ground just shook. Something landed to my left about 40 feet to our left. And we felt the ground shake. And because I was down lower than my buddy, I saw two footfalls. But he got out of there so quick. And at that time, I didn't know what it was at that moment. And my buddy thought it was a bear. But I just knew a bear wouldn't have shook the ground like that or moved that fast. The sound we heard was, and it was gone. That was it. It was just gone in like 2 seconds.
So, took off running on 2 feet?
On 2 feet, yeah.
Okay.
So we looked at each other. We thought bear or something at the beginning. And as we started walking, going up the trail, we were going back and forth saying cat, bear, because a cat was the only thing that could move that fast. But a bear was the only thing that we could think of that would shake the ground. So as we came back, I went back over to the tree. And I started going up the tree, and I could see right away that the view I had was about the first 20 feet of the beginning of the trail. Now, this is a dirt road we drive down. Nobody on the road. It goes up in elevation, and that's where the spring and the trail is. And we just pulled off to the left. There's about four or five cars can park there. And behind the car was where the trail started. But when I got up on the tree, I was looking down the first 20 feet of the trail, and I could see his car. And then I said, wow, whatever it was watching the parking lot. So we got down, and it wasn't until I got home and started looking in that area that I realized there was Bigfoot in that area. And then instantly I knew that's what it was. My buddy is still convinced it was either a cat or a bear.
Maybe a little disbelief there, possibly.
Yeah. There definitely is. He's funny. I ran across some eyeshine down in Mayo, Florida last May. We were traveling from Mobile to Daytona, and I could see the eyeshine coming up the road, and I was trying to point it out to him, and he just kept glancing at it, going, it's a reflector. Oh, it's something in the tree. But I saw the head tilt. I could see the eyes just tilt, and then the thing went down, and he would not stop. I had camera in my hand. I was ready, and he just kept going.
It's also, they know. It's guys like that. They know what they're looking at. They know something's not right, but they also don't want to admit it.
Right.
Yeah, it's a little the denial factor.
Yeah, there. You know. Right. Those kind of guys. I've got buddies just like that type, you know. Oh, it was a bobcat.
It was a
bobcat. Sure, keep telling yourself that.
Right.
Now, that eyeshine in Florida, what did you think that was from?
I don't know, but it was big white eyes. They were standing, they were off the road in the swamp, and they seemed to be about 6 or 7 feet in the air in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then as we got closer, I saw it go right to the ground. First the head tilted, and then it went to the ground, and then as we went by at that moment, and that was, I couldn't see any figure, any silhouette or anything. It was in the middle of the night. But
right,
the
you wouldn't see much if he didn't want to stop and take a look.
Yeah, we were kind of in a hurry, I guess. I don't know. But I was a little...
Or maybe he was in a hurry.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and anytime, like the sighting I had up here, I asked him to come up about a few weeks later, and I can't get him to go out in the woods. He'll deny it all the time, but he won't come out and look. You know?
Oh, boy.
Yeah, he's slowly coming around, though. You know, he's slowly.
Some people, it's such a game changer, you know, in your own mind as far as what you believe
right.
is real and isn't real in the world. When you find out something like this that certainly should not exist, does
right,
you know, it depends on how quick the person's willing to accept that, you know, and sort of incorporate it into their own belief system.
Yeah, and I think I'm lucky in that respect, because I was young. I was about 12 or 13 when I absolutely knew there was something out there.
Yeah,
you know,
after your first encounter, did you go back and look around any more in that area, or
about 2 years later? Yeah, in just this past let's see, we went in the fall, in November, we were up there again. We took a hike up that same trail, and then we went to another area and looked around, but we didn't see anything or find anything.
Well, unfortunately, that's the way it is sometimes. A lot of people, you know, especially there's now, our people are being coached, you know, to sort of approach this subject a little differently than everybody else has in the past. Which is pretty haphazard, I think, in most cases.
Yeah, right.
We're trying to do things a little more systematically and a little more, I guess, along scientific lines as much as we're able to.
Right.
Being untrained, you know, scientifically. But,
yeah.
You know, most people getting into the subject, if anybody's listening, you know, that really, you know, I know a lot of people think, well, there's so many people out looking for Bigfoot, how come they haven't found anything? Well, part of, you know, there's different reasons for that. You know, part of it is, you know, the Sasquatches themselves, of course, because they view us as kind of a predatory figure.
Right.
And the way they move, how they feed throughout their ranges, that accounts for the bulk of why we don't get close to them. But the other part is, when you look at the people involved in the subject, you know, people drive out to an area, they get out of their car, and they walk around a little bit, and they figure, well, I don't see anything, so they don't get anything.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Or if they... or if they do find something, you know, they find tracks. And it's, I just finished the Bigfoot Fieldwork 101 book, volume 7, that deals with searching areas. And when you think about searching areas, if you find something, you know, before people just go tromping in and they take pictures and don't look at anything else. And, you know, you have to make a determination when you see something like that. And I usually stop and look the whole area over before I go look at tracks or anything.
Right.
To see if there people have been there, you know, to see if it's a possible hoax.
Right.
And I can give you an example. This is, I know, a little bit off track, but I knew a guy back in the 90s was sent out by Rene DeHinden on a track, or a witness saw a Sasquatch. There was a line of tracks. He cast about a dozen of the tracks and then went home. And when I talked to him, I said, well, did you follow the line of tracks? Did you go, you know, where it came from and then follow where it went? No. Did you go back again? No. Well, right. How do you know anything about that? I mean, you walk away with a few casts and then, you know, there's nothing happens with that. So that's, unfortunately, that's what happens with this subject is,
right.
You know, people don't really do anything in detail with it. So,
right.
Sorry to get off that.
No, no, bit, that's but. No problem. that's no problem. I don't think I've always been told because I'm a Virgo, I have to know everything about everything, how everything works. And so when I had my second encounter, which was just over a year ago, I was there for 3 hours in that spot. And I just scoured that area, except for there was an area I just was not comfortable going into. And I had talked to you, well, actually, I commented on one of your other shows about what happened to me out there. I was the one that got I was the one that got whistled at as I was leaving the cemetery.
Well, let's go ahead and start with that one then.
Okay.
Now, this is your second encounter, right?
Yes.
And you said it was about a year ago. What were you doing that day? What lead us up to what happened?
Okay, this area, 5 years ago, I started using Google to try to find a funnel. I started getting into the subject again after that encounter in 2000. So about 2005, I thought I identified a funnel area. I was going by the theory that the Sasquatch live in the mountains in the summer, and then they come down to the ocean in the winter, which I since found out that's not true. They seem to migrate in a circle in this area.
Sure.
So I thought I found a funnel area, and I went to the cemetery, and I found a set of old tracks going right across the cemetery. And that's all I found there. They were older tracks, but I could tell it was a trackway, and there was no other footprints in the area. So that was 5 years ago. 4 years ago, I didn't go back. 3 years ago, I went back and didn't find anything. And I'm going back always in January.
Right.
Okay. So 2 years ago, I went back and there was nothing there. And then a year ago, a friend of mine gets a hold of me on Facebook saying, hey, why don't you look at this post? And it was two girls up in this area that went to that same cemetery and saw Bigfoot tracks and freaked out and screamed and ran. So I said, oh, geez, and I went right up there the next day. So I went up there the next day. I walked into the area, and as I was coming, this cemetery is out in the middle of the woods. It's just over a quarter-mile road to get to the cemetery, but there's no access anywhere else during the wintertime. You can't even drive up the road. They don't plow it. So as I'm walking into the cemetery, at the very far left-hand corner of the cemetery, I can see three deer sitting there feeding, and they didn't seem to be paying attention to me. They could have, I don't know if they would have heard me. I was walking in snow and I was being quiet. As I got into the cemetery, probably about 50 feet, now it's about 500 feet from the entrance to where I get into the cemetery to the end where the deer were. The deer, as I got into the cemetery, the deer all took off to my left. At that moment, when I watched them running, I saw what looked like a rooster tail of snow go up in the air and straight back down to my right. Mm-hmm. And what it looked like was, if you know that picture that everyone refers to when they talk about the Fibonacci, it's the girl swinging the water over her head and the water.
Okay.
that spiral that was made in that with that water, that's exactly what I saw in snow go up in the air and come straight down. And I'm looking over there, and I couldn't see any movement at all. I couldn't figure this out. I stared at that corner, and nothing. Didn't see anything move, so I kept going forward after a few minutes. And then I came to the trackway, and it ran from left to right, right in the middle of the cemetery. And then I noticed this is the same spot that the trackway was 4 years prior when I was there. Mm-hmm. So I walked all around into the woods of the cemetery, walked everywhere around the cemetery, except in the corner that I saw the snow come up. I just didn't feel comfortable going over in that area. I found older tracks in the woods around the cemetery, no other tracks in the cemetery, just around it. So I spent about 2.5-3 hours there, and I measured all the tracks, got some pictures, and pictures really don't come out that great, but I did get the measurements, and they were all 8 feet. Except where it slowed down near a tree. It looked like it was going to go under a little tree, and then it took off again at 8 feet. It was 7 feet coming up to the tree, and then immediately... And
this is the spacing between tracks?
Yes. Yeah, sorry.
Okay.
So after being there and checking everything else out, I didn't find, hair. I was looking for hair where it entered the cemetery. It's pretty shrubby where it entered the cemetery, but where it left the cemetery goes right into old woods. So I wasn't quite sure. I actually lost its tracks right at the edge of the cemetery. There was no more fresh tracks, but there was a tree right there. So it may have gone up the tree.
Did you have any idea how big the footprints were themselves?
Yeah, they were 18 inches. It was tough to measure because when he ran in the snow, he was running... with like a
right, bump, and you get slippage and all kinds of things that go on with snow.
Yeah, he was on the ball of his feet. Looked like the balls of his feet is what was impacting. The heel was always up in the air, kind of like the position of a woman in a high heel is what I was seeing.
Or like a track runner maybe.
Sorry. Or like a track runner, right? Because the snow was about 3 feet there, 2.5-3 feet deep.
Right.
And there was no drag marks between footprints. So he was coming in, going, he was making clear exits and entrances in that snow.
He was actually picking his feet up instead of, know, like we kind of shuffle in a way when we run a little bit.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
And Sasquatches move completely different than humans do.
Yeah, they could see that. I could see how they were picking their feet up out of each track.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't dragging it out.
No.
So after I spent the time there, about 2.5 hours, I started to leave the cemetery. And just as I got to the entrance, I still had the camera in my hand, too, but just as I was leaving the cemetery, I get this whistle. It sounded like 5 consecutive different bird calls, all right in a row and loud. And as it was whistling, I turned around, and in the corner of that cemetery where that snow came up into the air, I saw either his shoulder or the top of his head duck down in the tree, and I saw the branch move. And at that moment, I realized that I still have quite a ways to go to get out of this place. And that's when I got the feeling. That's the feeling everyone talks about. That's when I got it at that moment. I just put my hand up, and I gave him an open hand wave and said, goodbye. Like, see ya.
And let me ask you now. Now, where you saw that individual, was that where the tracks, the running line of tracks went to?
No.
Okay, so there was potentially 2 creatures there.
They could have. These tracks were 2 days old now.
Oh, they were 2 days old. Okay.
Yeah, the girls that saw him the day prior, they got clean prints. They said they could clearly see toes and everything. When I showed up the next day, some snow had blown into them. I could still make out the toes. I could still make out the prints, but I didn't get the clean print that they had. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, when this thing... and another thing is where that snow came up in the air from the woods, I didn't want to get... I just didn't feel right going in that corner. But I could see an area of disturbed snow, almost shoveled out snow. That's when I asked that question about if Sasquatch buried themselves. And then that's what it looked like. It almost looked like he was buried there and he might have come up out of the snow when I came in.
Possibility, but, for sure.
Yeah, there was a big disturbance of snow pushed aside, and something either looked like it was digging in that whole area, but it didn't quite look like a dig. It looked just like disturbed snow with a void in the middle.
Kind of like you maybe threw snow over the top of him, maybe?
Kind of. Threw it on top of him and then blew out of it fast when he saw it.
Yeah, we found... I know. I think I know what you mean. Kind of like you were... Well, what you were telling me, what Titmus did years back, Will, when he got... when he was up in near Bluff Creek and he got caught out. It was getting late. He didn't want to risk humping out and breaking a leg, so he kind of covered himself up. Kind of the same concept. You know, Don and I were kind of talking about a theory, you know, maybe they do sort of something similar.
Yeah. It wasn't cold that day, though.
You know, and I heard an old story. I think it was you that told me about this old, there's an old elderly Native American woman had noticed a female Sasquatch running down a hill. I think it was in Montana, and she was holding her side like she had been shot. And there was a bunch of white men that were were chasing behind. So the little girl hid. You know, back then a little native girl didn't want to be caught by five white hunters, you know.
Sure.
So she watched this Sasquatch get in the creek, bury itself, cover itself up with mud and vegetation real quick. These guys walked right over the top of it, didn't even see it.
Well, that's entirely possible. Yeah. I mean,
so that's a possibility, you know.
I thought
camouflage
this thing,
I
thought this one might have been hunting.
Hunting, you know.
That's what I thought, because those deer were right there. They were probably 50.
Well, and that's more than likely what was going on. And we see that a lot of times if somebody sees a Sasquatch doing something, and there are deer present, it's almost always what's happening. They're hunting.
Right. Sure. Yeah. These deer were right there. I mean, 50 feet from him.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, who knows? You know, the snow flurry in the air might have been a sign of frustration that you entered the area and disturbed the hunt.
Yeah, it could have been, right.
I mean, of course, you know, we're only guessing, but...
Right.
I mean, you sort of have to look at the context of the situation. If it was hunkered down, hiding, especially upwind of the deer, and was about ready to grab one, and then here you come... entering the scene, the deer take off, and you know, it's kind of ticked off because you spoiled its hunt.
Right. Yeah. Now, see, what that's the question I have now. When I was leaving the cemetery, I got whistled at. I thought it might have been him calling me back, trying to get me to come back, because I know you had said he might have been letting the other ones know, but
probably yeah.
Okay, but between that area,
now I'll tell you.
Go ahead.
I interviewed a hunter. Oh, probably 20 years ago or more, south of Mount St. Helens, and he was up, I can't remember if he was deer or elk hunting, but he was up on a logging road, and in an area where these things were, you know, seen for probably 200 years.
Right.
And he said he had this thing in his rifle sights, and it turned around and kind of looked at him, and it wasn't really going away fast, so it kind of turned back and kept going, so he decided to follow it. And it was almost moving at a pace, he said, where, you know, initially he didn't think about the fact that it was leading him someplace, but he followed it for some distance. And then he got to a place where it sort of kept watching him to make sure he was back there. And then he saw another one hiding behind a log or some trees or whatever. And he said, that's when it dawned on me, this thing's leading me into an ambush.
Right.
So then he turned around and took off.
Right.
You know, so they're not above doing things like that. Now, it's very. I mean, again, we can speculate,
right?
We don't have the full picture of what was going on, and that goes back to, again, you know, those thorough searches of areas afterwards, you know, sort of get the whole picture of what was going on there. But, you know, without that, that's all we can do is speculate. I mean, so it really kind of boils down to a couple of things, possibilities, like you said. Either it was maybe because you spoiled the hunt. You know, we got a hungry Sasquatch there, maybe more than one.
Right.
And maybe it thinks it can entice you back and you can take the place of those
deer.
Tasty deer. Or it was signaling the others, maybe that, you know, and again, we don't know the position of the creatures and exactly what was going on, because, you know, they may have had an ambush set up, or that was a signal that said, hey, you know, I lost the game are heading that direction or whatever. I mean, you know, we don't know, because... any kind of vocalizations or sounds these things do, just like other primate groups, chimps, gorillas, and such.
Yeah.
They make similar sounds from one group to the next, but the sounds mean something different from one group to the next. They're group specific.
That's a good point. Well, I don't think a lot of people realize that.
Right.
Yeah, it's not, you know, everybody tries to, you know, humans, that's a bad habit we have. We try to rubber stamp one meaning to everything because, you know, it's like, especially today, you know, in the fast food information society, you know, because things come at us so fast, we want to label something and put it in our little storage memory.
That's right.
And then when something comes up again, we have a, you know, the quick answer for it. And really, with this subject, there aren't any quick answers, and that's what gets a lot of people frustrated.
And the same thing with the looks of these creatures, too. It's not going to be all universal. Exactly. They're going to look different. You, myself, and Don, we look different. They're not going to have the same universal length of hair. You know, and with the feet, you know, the larger... Just because a footprint is 18 inches long doesn't mean the creature is going to be 9 feet tall.
Right. There's going to be some variations. Exactly. And then no two footprints are going to be identical.
That's right.
because of the wear patterns and
that's
such.
Right.
So,
right.
And that goes back to things we talked about. You know, you can identify individuals by their feet because of the individual wear patterns.
Right.
Yeah. Right, yeah, I'm going to try to, I did go out to that cemetery this February, and we didn't get much of a snow up here. We got about 10 inches of snow, and I went out there about 2 days after that, and there was a faint track there in the same place again. See, I don't know, that trackway that I've seen three times in that cemetery has been in the same place. I was thinking maybe he's dividing that. Like that's because
here's what I used to find, and I was telling Jeremiah, you know, once that when I first figured out how they were moving throughout their ranges, it took me 12 years to figure out one group's patterns.
Right,
and I could narrow it down to roughly within a 30-day time frame, and there was one particular area they used to come through, and it was like clockwork every year. It was almost in exactly the same place every time they would come through there. And I'd go up there when the first snow was on the ground, and that's when I'd see tracks. That's how I knew when they were in there. And it was January, February, that time frame.
Right.
So sometimes they will follow exactly the same places. Sometimes they won't. I mean, and it affects or is affected by, you know, things. There's a lot of factors. Things like, you know, how much human activity is there. If they're not pestered a whole bunch and the food supply is there, they're going to come there.
Right.
If that changes, then their behavior is going to change. Then they'll move slightly, you know, whichever area is more convenient or to another adjacent, you know, route that they'll follow.
Yeah. This is a small funnel area where they have access to the ocean, and there's tons of mussels there. And I had gone to where they would probably go if they were going to this ocean area, and there's a nice patch of woods there they can just hide in and jump out and grab some mussels and go right back in.
And have you ever seen any sign down there?
I went out there once, and it's private property, so I was asked to leave.
you haven't actually talked to the owners yet?
No. No.
See if you could go take a look?
No, and I gave the guy my name. He was renting out there or taking care of a property near this piece of woods, and he saw me out there walking the beach, and he came and told me it was private property, and I didn't really want to say exactly what I was doing there. I told him I was following a fox, is what I said. So, and
you know, it's funny with this subject. You know, it sort of break down social barriers.
Yeah,
and I found people that I would never rub shoulders with, you know, in everyday life. Who have contacted me that have had an experience like this, or sometimes just people that are interested, you know, that will actually open up and talk to you on a level that they never would otherwise.
Right.
And you'd be amazed. Sometimes you go contact someone and say, hey, you know, this is what I'm doing. Would you mind if I looked around on your property?
Right.
And when they figure out you're not going to do anything, you know, destructive to their property or steal anything, you're out looking for Bigfoot, maybe they think, okay, let's let Cuckoo out here to go look for Bigfoot.
right.
not that they would. I've never had that reaction from anybody, but people are usually kind of, they're kind of intrigued, you know, and usually they give you the okay. And half the time I've had the owners follow me around themselves,
right,
you know, and they're full of questions. So,
yeah, I'm gonna,
you know, give that a try sometime.
Yeah, I'm going to, the owners show up in the summertime. They're gone in the wintertime. And,
yeah,
he said,
get written permission. So if anybody asks, you've got written permission to be on the property.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, I'm gonna definitely go down there and try to go check that section of woods out near the beach too.
Sure.
There's nobody goes out there because it is private property, you know. And this place is pretty quiet up here during the wintertime. You know, a lot of people stay indoors. You know.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. Well, the bad weather and stuff.
Yeah. But now I'm gonna definitely check that one out, and I have an area right behind my house, about a mile right into the woods. I'm gonna check that because that's where I think they're coming through. There's railroad tracks there, and there's a river that follows the railroad tracks.
Right.
And there's two areas where they have sightings up here over the past 10 years, and I am right between both of these two areas. So.
And I'll tell you something. A lot of times they will follow tracks and waterways. As a means of navigation. I mean, there's other reasons they follow those kind of places, because they also serve as game trails, because game will follow, they'll follow the path of least resistance.
Right.
Which
right.
is, you know, electrical power line conduits,
yeah.
railroad tracks, old logging yep. roads, trails, yeah. you name it. Game is going to follow those because they're easy to follow.
Right. And power
and
lines.
Anything that's hunting, the game is going to follow those areas too.
Absolutely.
Right. Power lines do come right next to this cemetery too.
There you go. So yeah. Now check the power lines out.
Yeah, that's
a lot of people.
Yeah.
A lot of people years ago missed the mark because a lot of sightings took place along power lines and places like that, and they thought, oh, maybe they're just walking along the power lines. They missed the mark. They're game trails.
They're game trails, right? But they wouldn't actually go down the power line trail. They'd probably parallel the power lines, right?
They would parallel it, sure. Or actually, they would approach from an adjacent direction. Because they don't want to, if you're going to hunt something that's on, let's say, a power line trail, mm-hmm. you don't want to come walking down it because you're going to alert your
right.
meal
right.
of your presence. So you're going to sneak up on it from an adjacent direction.
Right, right.
You know, or set up an ambush around that area. So that's why they might be seen there. It's the same thing. It's like back in the 70s, you know, when John Green wrote his books,
yeah.
Him and the original guys, they all said, well, you know, 70 or 80% of all sightings happen on or near roads.
That's where the people...
But nobody... Yeah, right. But see, Sasquatches weren't walking down the highways.
Right. Right.
And everybody sort of missed the mark. With this high a number, nobody really sat down and said, oh, well, geez, maybe we should take a look at something, at some reason why they're doing that. Well, you know, what's the percentage of deer that are hit and killed along highways?
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's a real problem in a lot of places. So,
yep, yeah.
you know, if your food source is walking and grazing along highways, well, you know, whatever is preying on them is going to go where the game is, and it just happens to be along highways in many cases.
Right, right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I plan to go down those power lines.
Yeah, absolutely. Take a look at them.
And I've been asking Jeremiah, and I did ask you on one of the shows what I should be looking for, because I'd like to track this group. Try to follow them, figure out where they're going.
Well, the easiest way, the things to look for, and from my sources, there were, and these are inside sources, and I won't elaborate on that. But,
okay.
These things make primarily two kinds of markings. One are the snap trees, and the other one, they didn't specify, but it's likely the rock stacking. Now, the rock stacking is something that's not found. That's not easily found. That's usually way off the beaten path somewhere.
I'm about to tell you that, Don. Yeah. Oh,
okay.
That's usually high country. That's usually where people aren't going to find that.
Right.
I've got at least 10 or 11 sites up and down the West Coast, and you got to find them going cross country. You can't find them near roads.
Right, right.
But the broken trees...
You're talking
now, that one.
Talking about big rocks,
yeah,
big rocks.
Pretty good sized ones, okay. Usually, yeah.
Okay, nothing that.
Yeah, because now I spoke with some native friends who said that oftentimes, like with Indians, for instance, they will stack rocks during prayers, but they're little ones, little stacks, you know.
Right.
And these guys, when they do it, they're usually, you know, pretty good sized piles or stacks.
Okay.
But that's not the common one. The one you'd be looking for, and I still don't know what to think about some of these structures that people claim, because it's not something, I've been out there a long time, it's not something I've really noticed out and about. But the snap trees, now when something snaps a 3-inch Douglas fir tree,
right,
you know, that's 20 feet tall at a 90 degree angle, 8 feet off the ground, that grabs my attention pretty fast.
Right.
Because nothing else is going to do that. Now, you know, living in that part of the country, I mean, you've seen probably every kind of weather break
that
we have in the Pacific Northwest as well. You know what those look like.
Right.
In the middle of July, the first time I found one, and I was told about these by Bob Titmus. I went to his house once and he showed me all these things. He had all these little, they were little alder branches. They looked like maybe an inch thick, and they were kind of snapped over and twisted over. And he had piles of these things. And he says, well, you might watch for these. He says, you know, up around Bluff Creek, when we were finding all the footprints back in the 60s, I found a lot of these, you know, in conjunction with the footprints. So he says, I don't know, maybe they just walk along and are snapping these over. So I didn't really think much of it because, I mean, weather does that. Lots of things do that.
Right.
So we were up in an area south of Mount St. Helens back in 1991, and we hiked about 2,200 feet elevation up this slope in this, was a river watershed area. No human access. We had to go cross country, and took us five times to get into this place because it was so difficult to navigate. We stopped for a break, and I happened to look over, and I saw this tree, and it was, like I said, it was a Douglas fir tree. Now, this is, remember, middle of July. It was warm, had been warm for at least a month. The tree was probably 3.5 inches thick, the trunk, about 20, 25 feet tall, and it was snapped. I mean, 90-degree snap. Not even the twigs around the break were broken.
Wow. Right.
And you know, Doug fir doesn't break like that naturally. If the wind hits it or something, it's kind of long, sinewy breaks.
Right. Right.
And then I got looking, and about every 100 yards, I found one of these along this small ridge that ran along the major ridge system. And it was in a closed canopy. There were, all the conditions were against weathering or anything else. This was purposely done.
Right.
And I measured the height of the break off the ground, and it was all within an inch or two of 8 feet.
Huh.
And then there were old accounts. You know, there was an account back in Sports Field magazine. This was from Alaska, and I think it was around, I want to say it took place around the 1940s or so, because I think the story was 1963. It was called Long Hunter, Alaskan Style, or something like that. And it was about a couple of guys that were up there trapping, and there was a group of Indians, and they talked about this creature that was in the area. They called it Gilyuk, and they said, Gilyuk's not hunting caribou, they eat men. And he said they can prove it. They took the guys to the place where it left its mark, and it talked about this birch sapling that was twisted like a matchstick. And if you think from that time period, there weren't any paper matchsticks yet. They were all wooden.
Yeah, right.
So I thought, well, how would you twist a matchstick in your hands? And if you ever tried to twist one of those old wooden matchsticks,
they splinter.
It's really, you really can't do it. So what you twist it. Now, you have to think about terminology from the time period.
Yeah, right.
When they say twisted, they probably meant snapped.
Yeah.
And it's exactly the condition we find these trees in. And it's usually very dramatic. And the one we found, or ones we found, were freshly done. They were only about a week or two old tops.
Why do you think they do them?
Well, my Indian buddies told me it was for one of two reasons. They said either it was territorial marking, or it was the alpha marking the direction of travel from one of their foraging areas to the next.
Okay.
And that was to let the main group know which way to go.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And actually, I found out there was another reasoning. Now, in places where there's a lot of human activity, let's say there's a big clearing somewhere, and people go there and do things a lot, but they don't really get out beyond that. And I found this in Northern California here a number of years back, a place just like that. And the trees, there were trees that ringed that area. Again, you know, these young trees, and they were snapped about every 50, 60 feet around this, and they told me that it was as a warning to others of their kind that this is where humans are. Don't go here.
Okay.
So whether that's true or not, I mean, I've seen that out in the field. So without being able to prove it, you know, we can't say for sure, but it's pretty interesting anyway. And those are the kind of things you want to watch for, especially the fresh markings, because that tells you they've been there recently.
Right, right. Do you think they mark areas, say if they find a good hunting area, do you think they would mark it, or would they just remember
They could mark it, but I think a lot of times it's navigational use.
It's now, okay.
Because they cover such big regions. Now, their ranges are a minimum of 500 square miles. Minimum.
Yeah, right.
Per group. So they're moving, and it's nothing for them to move 20 miles out from, say, a bedding area to a hunting area.
Wow.
You know, they can cover these large sections of ground pretty easily where it's, you know, we think in our terms where it's tough for us, but... You know, I can tell you when I was in the military, you know, we used to practice, 20-mile road marches on foot fairly often. So it's something that can be done. We can do it.
Yeah.
They certainly can do it.
They can do it, right. All right, yeah, I'm going to start probably here next week. I'm going to try to track those guys. I'm going to wait for the water to go down a little bit. Still a little wet out in the swamp areas out.
Now, is it typically this time of year? Well, not this time of year. It would be, what, January, February, when you see them in that area?
From the middle of January to the end of February. That's usually when they're
there.
So
you get some flexibility. Now, you might look. Now, they're going to move, of course, because they move. And you've got an idea of the circular pattern they move in that area?
I have an idea, yeah. There seems to be sightings from here all the way to Augusta, Maine. There's actually a lot of sightings just south of Augusta and just north of Augusta.
Have you checked the dates on the sightings? You know, because typically they'll move about every 14 days from one feeding area to the next.
Oh, okay. The ones that are in Augusta, they're always in the summertime.
Okay.
You know, I don't hear too
many.
A couple in the winter.
How far away is that from your area?
It's about 45 miles.
Okay. So that's reasonable then. They're moving. You could probably, if you looked at those sightings from your area to that area, and everything in between, you should be able to plot.
Right. Yeah,
how far they're moving and the rate of speed.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know if there'd be more groups over that way. I didn't know if they intermingled.
Well, there could be. Yeah.
Okay.
See, that's the trick. See, now that's why we want to learn. That's the importance of information like.
Okay.
Footprints, for instance, okay?
All right.
Footprints tell you, like, how many individuals are in a group. You can identify groups.
Yeah.
And because the ranges will overlap, it'll help you determine if there are more than one group there.
Okay.
Or in an adjacent area and all that, and what they're doing, and even how they would respond to one another.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that is how I found that funnel area, just by plotting the sightings, and I could tell they were moving towards the ocean in that direction, and then I just used Google to find an access point to the beach, you know.
Yeah, there you go.
And it was the first time I looked, and I found tracks. I was a little surprised. I didn't see them for 2 years, though, after that. But
and see, a lot of people might be surprised at that, but really, I mean, you're talking about a wild creature. We know something about what they do and how they do it.
Right.
And based on what we know, we should be able to plot these things and go out and, you know, and that's how science is supposed to work. You know, you come up with the theory or, you know, how your plan of attack, you know, what you think is going to happen and make a prediction and go out. And if your prediction bears out, well, then, you know, your theory is sound.
Right. Huh. Well, that one worked.
I'm not a scientist, so I can't word that right, but
no,
you know,
I
think I got close to it there.
Right.
But see, we should be able to make predictions based on what we know, and that's what always gripes me. All these groups go out there in kind of a, you know, a half-cocked fashion, and they think they're going to go find Bigfoot, you know, by screaming and beating on trees or whatever stupid idea that they've come up with.
Right.
And then they walk away empty-handed when they say, well, I think I saw one peek around a tree, or I thought I heard something. Well, thinking you see or hearing something doesn't do anything. It's when you're able to take what you know, make a prediction, go out and find things, prove your prediction. That's when it means something.
Yeah.
And what you did is right on the mark.
Yeah, I didn't shut up about that one for like 2 years to everybody. But I still don't have a picture. Of course, that's what they want, you know.
Well, and I'll tell you something, you know, everybody is trying to be Roger Patterson all over again. I sort of jokingly call it the 1966 syndrome because, you know, Patterson got the film in 67, so everybody's in the position the year before.
Right.
You know, and everybody forgets that those guys were still trying to determine if there really was something real or not. They weren't out trying to do everything everybody's doing today. Right. They were trying to make a decision so they could convince the scientific community that says, hey, look, there really is something out there. You guys need to do something.
Right. Right.
And when Patterson got the film, they showed the scientist. Everybody says,
Right.
You know, and so everybody missed the point afterwards, and they're still trying to do the same thing, and scientists are going to do the same thing. If you could get 100 films,
right,
and scientists are still going to say, well,
right,
you know, we don't have any proof,
right, exactly,
that could be fake, you know, and all the, you know, the reasonings and things. So
it's tough. Yeah, even when that one whistled at me, I had my camera in my hand. All I had to do was push the power button. And it never occurred to me till I was walking out that I had the camera in my hand that whole time. It's
amazing how that works. I was telling the guys on Blab, I think last week was Jeremiah, about my buddy and Jack and I were in Northern California here a number of years back. And now, granted, we were tired. We'd been out since dark early, and it was 1 o'clock in the morning when we were heading back to camp. So we'd been out a long time that day, and we both had cameras in our hands, film cameras, movie cameras. So I happened to notice, you know, you see in the peripheral light from the headlights, you know, on the sides of the road, and there was an adjacent road that angled into the main road we were on, and we were going very fast, maybe 20 miles an hour up there, because, you know, it's a kind of rough country in there.
Right.
And we had been talking that day about, because we see bear up there every time we go there, and we have yet to this day to actually get a picture of a black bear up there.
You're right.
Even though we see them every doggone time we go there. So
yeah,
I happen to notice some movement on that adjacent road, and here comes this little year-old black bear just running like hell, and he cuts in right in front of the Yukon we were driving. And I said, Jesus Christ, look at that. You know, here's this little bear just running like hell in front of us, and Jack speeds up trying to pace him. And we're following for a good little amount of time. It probably wasn't in actual time, not very long, but, you know, maybe a minute or two. But it was long enough to get the camera up and push the power button, you know, and take a picture of it, right? The bear zips off. We slow down, and we're saying, well, how about that? And I said, you know what? Some Bigfoot hunters we are. Neither one of us got a damn picture of that bear. So what are we going to do if we see a Bigfoot up here?
Right. Yeah, it's that amazement of nature. I don't know. I watched a bald eagle chase a crow around my yard for 20 minutes with a camera 20 feet from me. And I always think of it afterwards, you know?
Yeah,
exactly.
Always, you know.
And I think that's what happens most time. You know, people go, even if they, you know, and that's one of the questions here. Everybody's got a camera today. How come nobody's got a picture of a Bigfoot?
Yeah,
there's
lots of factors now, coming.
Yeah.
No pictures isn't true. I mean, I have actually one, and I think I sent you that one, Jeremiah, that I got from Michigan.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty good picture.
Awesome picture.
So, I mean, they are out there, but again, it's one of those things, you know, scientists would probably say, well, you know, it's not proof.
Right. Yeah.
I mean,
till one's on
now,
the table.
Having a lot of photographs, I think, would be a good thing. That would go a long way. Now, if we were able to predict an area, we had an area, we knew what was going on, we made some predictions, and then put our people, our teams in the field, we could bear out those predictions with evidence that's there, and if we could do it time and again, get what we called good National Geographic quality film footage, not just a minute or two, but hours worth.
Right.
With all the supporting evidence, footprints and territorial markings and feces and hair and all the other stuff that goes with that, if you had the combination of all of that stuff, you might have something.
That would make a difference,
but again, it would. Again, if you could get, you know, the right people to convince, you know, people that had no interest in the subject, you know, scientists and...
Yeah.
And I stress that because people who have an interest, who do have credentials, seem to be more about themselves and furthering, you know, their own career than they do dealing with the topic. So.
Right, right.
But that's my opinion anyway. So,
I don't care for that end of it either.
No, I know what you mean. I mean, it's kind of non-productive.
It is. Yeah, just people trying to make a few dollars off of it. Yeah.
Right. You know. So, now Jeremiah, you said Don, and you, yep. You had some other things that you've heard or seen.
Don, the Sasquatch that the lady saw that was covered in algae.
Oh yeah, that happened in 2011 in Stoughton, Mass, which is not far from where I had my sightings down in Easton, Mass. It's only about four towns away. They were in a conservation area where people walk. It has walking trails through there. And they were going in right after the thaw. There was still snow on the ground. I think it was in April of 2011. So they went in. There's a place called Goat Rock. It's just a rock along the trail that you can walk up to the top of. As they were coming up to it, they could smell something dead. And it kept getting stronger and stronger till they got to the rock. And these two women got up to the top of the rock and looked over the edge. And there was a Squatch with a deer over its shoulder looking right up at them. And it just took off running into the swamp. And they said it was It was all gray, but it had what looked like green algae all over it. So like it had come up out of the water at some point.
These things are said to be good swimmers, so that's entirely possible. I mean, I've talked to people quite a few times that have seen them in water, swimming water.
You think they'd just hide and hang out, or maybe even hunt from the water, too?
I know the Mohawks I'm talking to up here, they're known to hunt, dive for eels.
Wow.
Yeah, I suppose it's possible, sure. I mean, we know that they chase fish up in Alaska. They'll go out in the surf and catch fish. It's entirely possible. There's so much we don't know, especially about their feeding behavior. So
right.
But all these are pieces of valuable information, you know, we add to the database. So it's very interesting.
A good friend of mine had his encounter probably a mile as the crow flies from that sighting. He had his encounter in 1979, and he came 50 feet face to face with one, and they just stared at each other for a few minutes. But that one was the only one in the area that was not gray. That was the auburn brown, and you think it did have some gray in it. But he.
That's interesting. Yeah.
In all the pictures I showed him, Neanderthal. A Neanderthal man is what he said the face looked like. You know, and I've showed him lots of pictures, and he said that's the only one that comes close.
Have you seen that one that was done in Danny Vendramini's book, Them and Us?
Is that the one without the hair on the face?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, I did show him that one.
What do you think
he
of that
one? He said it wasn't... you know how that one has a massive jaw?
Right.
Yeah, he didn't have that massive jaw, he said. And the nose...
I wonder if that was...
The nose was bigger.
I wonder if that was more of the type 4 individual, Jeremy.
Could be.
Yeah, could I'd be. Like to get...
Could very well be, actually.
Yeah, we don't have a great deal of information specifically on that particular type yet, but it sort of sounds like
could
that.
Could be.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was right in Borderland State Park in Sharon, Mass. And the best part is...
Did he talk about the size of the creature or if the arms were long or, I mean, particulars like that?
It was massive, yeah. He said it was at least 8-9 feet, and it was just massive. He had trouble for a while after that. He was about 14 at the time, and he actually went into his room, hid under his bed. He really thought it was chasing him. He ended up running out of there, and he had a bicycle out on the road, took off home, and, of course, his parents didn't believe him. Nobody believed him. I met him 2 months right after his sighting. I met him 2 months after the sighting, and he didn't tell me. Even though he knew I was going out into the swamp every weekend, he didn't mention it to me for about 6 years, 5 or 6 years.
And I can understand that, being a teenager, you know, and running into these things.
Yeah.
Was in that situation myself, and fortunately my buddies, you know, we all had known each other for a few years, you know, before that he'd seen tracks, but so I only talked to them because my parents and siblings and everybody made fun of us for saying what we found footprints, you know.
Right.
We know what we saw, and my buddy John's dad took pictures and everything, so... But they still made fun of us, so we weren't about to talk about it after that. And I didn't talk to other friends. I only talked to the few who, you know, were involved in it. So.
Right, right. And I've been trying to get him to talk about it because he still, people still give him a hard time about it, you know.
See, and that's too bad because that sounds like a legitimate account. And it's, I guess he just needs to find the people to talk to. I mean, there's a lot of jokers out there, unfortunately. But
I tried to get him,
he wants to talk to us.
Right, I tried to get him to go on Chronicles. And then about in January 2014, he had a few beers one night. He picked up, they were on Coast to Coast, was talking about the Bridgewater Triangle. And he's in the last 5 minutes of that show, but he didn't hear the questions that were being asked to him. So there was no description, no anything given. It was a very quick one. But there is something interesting about that sighting my buddy had is I looked up some old maps of the town from the 1700s. And right where he had his sighting is on the creek. It's now called Man's Creek or something, but back then it was called Devil's Creek.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I thought that was funny.
and you know, one of the old names from a number of locations, you had something to do with devil when it came to these creatures from way, way back.
Right.
You know, either creek devil or mountain devil.
Yeah, the wood devil.
And that's what I named this show after, Creek Devil Journal. So.
Oh.
To sort of go back, you know, one of the older names because, you know, Bigfoot and Sasquatch has been kind of overused, I think.
Yeah. Right. But yeah, I know in that area they were called wood devils.
You know? See, there you go. Yeah. That's another reference. It was always something that had to do with devil.
Right.
And of course, you know, I think there's a number of reasons for that, you know, that go partially with the fact that these things, the way they move and how they deal with people and interact and things like that, you know, they were... And especially back then, you know, when they were still believing in witches and things, you know,
right.
You see some hairy man-like monster in the woods, you know, it's a devil, it's a monster.
Yeah, very religious people back then, right.
Very much so.
Yeah, in the middle of that swamp, this is another odd thing, in the middle of that Hockomock Swamp, they recently found a stone. A woman went missing about 100 years ago. That was another weird case. It looked like she was plucked from the canoe, is what the article says.
Yeah.
They searched for her for a couple weeks, and then, about a week. And a week later, they found her right there in the water where she went missing, dead.
That was the Brocken
devil,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. We're actually related to the family by marriage now.
And what's interesting, there are parallels to that, because in places like New Mexico and Pennsylvania, you know, that's spread across the country. There are stories of people, and even in Mexico...
Huh.
People being grabbed by these things right out of moving vehicles.
Yeah, I've heard a couple of those stories, or people, they tried to grab them anyway, you know.
Exactly.
Jeez, yeah, that's crazy. it must be the running away from them that triggers that instinct to just attack.
Predatory instinct.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's something people need to understand. These things are predators. So
I'm still listening.
Now, whether it's the chase or they're just running to grab... you know, quick meal, but well, fellas, we're just about out of time, I think.
Okay.
So, Don, Jeremiah, thanks for coming on. Don, I'm gonna have to wrap it up. We're about out of time here,
okay.
So we'll keep us posted. You know, as our team leader there in Maine, and of course, we'll be back to visit you again for updates that you have for us.
Okay, and I'm gonna start to research Eastern Mass too. I asked her.
Oh, good plan.
Yeah, I told I told him he could, you know, being from there, you know,
yeah,
he could take Eastern Mass if he wanted to. He knows the area very well, so
yeah, and I know a lot
right,
of the
absolutely.
No better guy to have there.
Yeah, I have a big family down in that area. A lot of them are police and guys, so I do have an in with the police departments down there.
Oh, good deal.
Yeah,
I've already contacted a couple of them. If they have any sightings, to get a hold of me, and they agreed, you know, so that's
good. Well, that's good to know.
Okay. Well, thank you, Will.
All right, fellas. Yep. Well, listen, thank you very much, and we'll talk soon.
Okay.
Hey, yes. Don.
We'll see you guys.
Thanks, buddy.
Have a good day.
You too.
All right. Bye.
Bye now.
Bye.